Welcome to the Strangers and Aliens podcast.
Strangers. To boldly say what needs to be said.
Would you be a stranger or an alien? Or would you be a strange alien?
The truth is out there. I am your father's best friend, Plumber. Superman.
Wonder Woman.
Heroes. Villains. Captain Picard versus Captain Kirk.
Do you think that there's room in sci-fi for God? The very first thing that God did was that he created something, so we have a creative God.
This is Strangers and Aliens Podcast.
Hello, and welcome to the latest episode of Strangers and Aliens. And I am Ben Avery, one of the Strangers and Aliens, who is here to be your host into the land of science fiction and fantasy and spirituality and Christianity. And
kind of a long title, Ben.
That's a really big one.
Yeah. It's not a title. It's more a job description.
It's not going to fit on the website.
No, but yeah. But it fits on the job description. No.
Well, I'm pretty much this card is going to be huge.
Well, let me make it very clear. I'm Dr. Jace, Ben's boss.
Yeah, that wasn't in the job description that they sent me. So.
And I am Steve MacDonald, unpaid minion.
Oh, that's good.
Otherwise known as intern. And we together, the three of us, are the Strangers and Aliens, along with you, our listeners. We are here to explore sci-fi and fantasy. So I think we should get started. In just a moment, though, actually, there's one thing I wanted to tell people about that I'm really excited about, and it's a way that you can help support Strangers and Aliens. There's an audiobook website that's part of Amazon called audible.com, and they sell... Or it's like a subscription kind of thing to get like audiobooks every month. Have you guys heard of this? Or
yes.
Used it?
Yes.
Have you used it at all?
I believe I have, yeah.
Okay. Well, I
have not.
Okay. I used it a long time ago to get a Red Dwarf audiobook that was read by Robert Llewellyn, who plays Crichton on Red Dwarf. And he also, I heard that in the book, as he's reading it, he does voices and does the imitations of the voices of the other cast members. And so I thought, I want to hear this, but I didn't really want to pay for it. So I accidentally found out about Audible and went ahead and signed up for it, got the free Red Dwarf book, and then quickly unsigned up. What's the word?
And that's legal.
It is. Well, that's the way it's set up. And we actually are affiliates with them now. So if you go to audibletrial.com/strangers, you can sign up for a free one-month trial and get a free audiobook. For example, I was looking through all the audiobooks, and I saw they had The Four Loves read by C.S. Lewis,
awesome.
Which I bought on iTunes and is one of my favorite things to listen to because you actually hear his voice. Have you ever heard his voice, guys?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've heard those.
That awesome, just baritone, rich voice. So anyway, it helps us out. Everyone who goes and signs up for the free trial, and you don't have to keep signed up. You don't have to pay anything. You can sign up for the free trial, and you can quit whenever you want. But if you do that, it actually helps us out a little bit, and you get a free book, and so everybody's happy, and I'm happy, Dr. Jace is happy, Steve is happy, you're happy, and we're all happy. So, yeah, so that's our little plug there for audibletrial.com/strangers, and we'll probably mention it again in the future, but yeah. So now on to our topic at hand, and I'm excited about this because basically we're going to be recommending some things to you, especially if you're younger and are into science fiction. And we're going to be talking about great science fiction movies from before the Star Wars era. Basically.
Oh, sorry. I, along with probably 75% of our audience, just fell asleep because I'm just going to be honest. Who cares? That's my opinion. There's really not that many quality. Before Star Wars, it's like, might as well just talk about when you invented the wheel, Ben.
Which actually is interesting. I was listening to a podcast the other day about the invention of the wheel. And it's actually an interesting story, and no, just kidding.
They'll never gonna wake up. We just lost like 75% of our audience.
No, we didn't. We didn't lose any of our audience.
Except for Gary and Roland, who are like old too, so.
That's the whole point here, is that we are going to recommend some movies to you that you might find interesting. And if not interesting, at least it's part of your geek cultural heritage. And I'm not recommending that you find these movies and study them intently and rewatch and rewatch and rewatch. But I do think that if you are into science fiction, especially if you want to write it or create it, these are things you need to see at least once and know.
We need to promote this to colleges, because if the goal of us is to educate, I guarantee you we're going to get a better response from our audience from you know, one of my college student classes or something.
Jace.
Wow.
So we know what side of the discussion you come on. You're actually the person we're trying to talk to, I think. Yeah. But
so your list would include like Star Wars, even though it didn't actually happen before Star Wars, but it was so close to happening at the exact same time as Star Wars that you can actually include it.
Well, and really, then, the only Star Wars I think was quality was the Christmas special. So,
yeah. Just kidding. Here's the thing about Star Wars that I was thinking about is Star Wars both gave us a science fiction renaissance and destroyed science fiction. Anyway, yeah, so we've all compiled a list, although I have not had any conversation with any of you about your list, so I'm wondering how long yours even is, Dr. Jace.
Well, I can tell you right
is
off
there one
the bat,
on there?
My top five is Snore. My number four is Who Cares? Number three is I'm Not Listening. Number two is You Are Totally Wasting My Time. And number five is Ba-dump Bump. I didn't really come up with five. I only had four.
And number six was More Kyle Bell.
Yeah. Number six was The Muppet Show. I don't know.
Was The Muppets before Star Wars?
No.
The Muppet Show.
Muppet Show
wasn't.
Was, but Pigs in Space was a reaction to Star Wars.
Yeah.
Well, Star Trek, but because of the Star Wars.
That's a whole nother topic right there, is what did we get right after Star Wars because of Star Wars?
Yeah.
Pigs in Space would be a great.
Yeah.
Without Star Wars, there would be no Pigs in
Space. Pigs in Space!
And honestly, without Star Wars, there would be no Star Trek Next Generation.
There wouldn't be.
It would have been a TV show.
What year was the original Star Trek movie made?
Well, the original Star Trek movie was made. It was greenlit after Star
Wars. Because Star Wars,
yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it was because of
79.
Star Wars. Everyone started looking, okay, what do we have that's kind of like Star Wars? But that's another conversation. That's the conversation I want to have in another episode. This is the episode about before Star Wars.
This is the great sci-fi
pre-Star Wars.
With only 5% of the population is still alive that was around back then.
What are you talking about?
I'm meaning that the people that would be interested in movies before that are mostly dead.
Well, we are talking about movies that were made before we were alive.
Dead people are very interested in these movies.
All right. Well, Dr. Jace, I'm not sure how much you're going to be able to put into this conversation. However, you are, it seems, our target audience for this conversation. Steve, let's get started. What do you think, Steve? What do you got for me? What do you got for Dr. Jace?
I actually have one.
Okay.
Which, because I have to say it, because I know everyone's going to say it, and I have to say it before you steal it, is Forbidden Planet.
I was just going to say that.
I know you were. That's
okay,
why I had
so
to
that's
jump
all,
in.
All three of us then have Forbidden Planet. How could you not?
We should call this like the Forbidden Planet episode, because all these movies should be like Forbidden Planets, but they can't be. So we should have that like set off to the side as sort of like the.
I'm confused. What?
All these movies should be
Forbidden Planet.
Forbidden Planet.
All of if a movie is like this, if a movie is seminal and really, you know, was that, it should be like some people say that was my Star Wars or that was my.
Oh,
okay.
Because I thought you were saying that all our list of five should be Forbidden Planet. I'm like, well, that's going to be a really short episode.
Thank you for listening, everybody.
Yeah, that episode would be as boring as what Dr. Jace was saying it's going to be.
No, because we could talk about it in five different ways.
I do have to, you know, point something out. There's a line in Star Wars that they took out where Han Solo is waiting for something and he says, "This is boring." And they took that line out because George Lucas or someone said, you know, as soon as one of your characters says, "This is boring," the audience is going to agree.
Right.
And so we've lost our audience, not because of our topic, but because of your attitude.
I offered up Forbidden Planet.
Yeah, after you talked about how terrible this episode's going to be.
Well, I told you my opinion before we picked the topic, so.
Have you seen Forbidden Planet?
I have, absolutely.
We talked about Forbidden Planet in our last episode.
Yeah. But sometimes he's just like riding in on the coattails and saying, "Oh yeah, I like Forbidden Planet as well."
Oh, don't get me wrong.
Chase doesn't ride on coattails. Not like
I'm a little cynical when it comes to pre-Star Wars, but don't get me wrong. I love sci-fi. And obviously I'm a Twilight Zone fan, so I have some decent knowledge with some sci-fi stuff.
And Forbidden Planet is
pre-Stone Age.
Not only a classic, it is really good, and it holds up.
Right.
It holds up surprisingly well.
Again, my only issue with it, I mean, I thought it was very, very good. It kind of reminded me of the best parts of Star Trek and Twilight Zone, in my opinion. It was kind of like a hybrid of the best parts of those, because most of my favorite Twilight Zones are the outer space ones. In fact, I skipped through a lot of the other ones to get to the space ones. But again, the issue that I had with it was that I've always known Leslie Nielsen as the comedic spoof guy. So it took me about half the movie to get over that.
Right.
He's young enough that it's almost like he's there's two different guys there. I mean, he's young enough that he doesn't have the gray hair that he has in his spoof movies, and he doesn't have the just the age.
No, but he's got that look. If you watch his eyes and the way he tilts his head, it just makes me want to laugh because I keep replaying scenes from the Naked Gun and all the others. So,
but he doesn't have those vacuous takes that he does in Naked Gun and stuff like that, where someone does something and he's just like, ooh, that take that he has, that he's accepting whatever just happened as if it was totally valid in the human realm of understanding, but it's not. And he just walks off, and things are exploding and stuff like that. He doesn't have that in Forbidden Planet.
I do think that this is testament to his abilities, though. I mean, he can do comedy really well, and he does bad comedy really well. He makes you laugh at really stupid stuff that you wouldn't laugh at if someone else was doing it.
Yeah. No, Even in a bad movie, he's funny.
Let me ask you about this, because you guys saw it, back before fire was discovered. So, Forbidden Planet, what was it that really spoke to you?
Well, the thing with Forbidden Planet for me is you've got an interesting plot. You've got special effects that do hold up and that don't feel as fake as a lot of movies from that time and after.
Yeah, there was some Disney animation with the invisible creature in the electric field. That was Disney animation.
That was brilliant for them to do because the creature, you never see the creature.
Yeah.
Except for an outline in electricity. And so you never, the illusion is never shattered the way it is in some, even modern movies where they finally show the creature, like in Cloverfield.
Yeah.
And you finally saw the creature. You're like, oh, well, okay. I'll go with it.
That's it.
It looks realistic, but it also looks stupid.
I will say, I know part of this is the way stories are told now compared to the way stories were told then. Although I enjoyed it because I'm a very big sci-fi fan. And like I said, it reminded me of Twilight Zone and Star Trek. I would say there are moments when I thought, kind of like Han Solo, this is boring. mainly because there are just moments where they have more wide takes, and nowadays you have quicker cuts and there's more going on. So, even though I really did enjoy it and I thought that it was done well for that era, it's hard for me, being of a different generation, not to think that from time to time that, this is a bit slow. But then I have to tell myself it's the era.
The other thing about the movie, though, is it's a mystery. And so it does unfold
Yes.
Slowly. And yes. That's going to happen in a mystery movie.
And that's what keeps your attention is the mystery in my mind. As far as if from a younger person's perspective, if they go into it thinking this is slow, you have to buy into the mystery part of it in order for it to keep your attention.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But the other thing is, if you are a fan of Star Trek, this is a movie you've got to watch, because this is the model. This is what they built it on.
Yeah.
And I know that they call it Wagon Train. We talked about this in the ripoff episode. But yeah. they call it Wagon Train to the Stars. But this is what I see as the model of where Star Trek came from.
Yeah. Well, so. Now, you know, after Forbidden Planet, I've got to say it before. I know one of you have to say it.
Oh, maybe, no. You don't get to do this twice.
Planet of the Apes. I got it in.
Is that on your list too, Steve?
Planet of the Apes, I knew that you were going to do it, so I didn't take space on my list to put it in.
Yeah, because I made Steve take his list of 24 and whittle it down to 5, and whittled it down to 12. But
12.
Ben, the original list was, I heard it like 213, so I think that would be good. And half of those weren't even movies. He was trying to fit in TV shows and comic books as well.
Well,
I thought of some books, too, that would be great for this list.
Like, yes, but we're focused on movies, right?
Yes, we are.
All right.
Okay,
So no radio shows.
No, TV. Unfortunately, because you know what? I could throw in a couple.
But we're not going to. Instead, we're going to talk about Planet of the Apes.
Yes.
Planet of the Apes, one of my favorite franchises. I love Planet of the Apes.
Okay. Now, I'm going to give a disclaimer here. You cannot talk about the newest one because I just got it from Netflix and my wife and I are planning on watching it. So do not give any tidbits away.
The newest one was after Star Wars, though.
I know. But, you know, sometimes we go off on tangents. Imagine that. So I'm just saying, don't say anything about the newest one or I will be mean to you.
You mean the big twist at the end?
Blah, 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 blah.
What a reveal. It was all the dream that JR had. It wasn't JR who had the dream.
No, it was the man from Atlantis.
It was Patrick Duffy.
Yeah.
All right.
So Planet of the Apes, 1967, 68? And I can tell you right now, I know one of the reasons why you love this movie, Dr. Jace.
Oh, yeah? Tell me.
Because Rod Serling wrote it.
That's true. It is. I actually thought you were going to go something simplistic like Charlton Heston is a beast. But yes, you're right.
Well, he is. That's true also. But this is a 2-hour Twilight Zone episode. And it is great. I love the ending. I love the twist, which is spoiled for you. If you buy this DVD, it's spoiled for you on the cover of the DVD. But most people have any kind of pop cultural awareness, they are aware of the ending of this movie.
Yes.
And but anyway, let's talk about this movie, because this is another one that there are some slow moments, but it's a good movie. So Dr. Jace, have you seen the fan edit of the Planet of the Apes, where they edited it into a half an hour and used an opening and a closing from two different Twilight Zone episodes for Rod Serling's voice, and then put it in black and white? So it's like it literally is a Twilight Zone episode.
No, email that to me.
I will find that link because it is awesome.
It sounds like it. First of all, anything that Serling does is brilliant. I mean, he's just so good.
Have you done the Twilight Zone ride at Disney World?
What?
The Twilight Zone ride, the Tower of Terror?
Yes, I have. I've done it multiple times.
What did you think of the framing sequence around that?
I mean, as far as when you say frame it, are you talking about the actual building itself or the story?
The little story they built around it.
Well, I'll tell you, the first time I ever wrote it, I was probably around, I believe I was 16 or something around there. I could be wrong. I remember being scared out of my mind because at first I was a little bit kind of like, I didn't know what to expect. I just walked in because I saw Twilight Zone, walked in, we got into it. And we go through these little stages, you know, where they're showing you the history of these people and you go up these different stories. And I'm thinking, wow, this is kind of, it's cool as from a Twilight Zone perspective, but I didn't expect the drop right when it happened. So, thought it was awesome. And so I ended up writing a few times because when I thought we were going to drop, we didn't. And then we dropped it all the way. It was cool. I loved it.
Cool.
So this is one of those tangents you were talking about when you said you didn't want to get the ending of Rise of the Planet of the Apes.
Yeah, no, exactly.
Okay, I see what you're saying now.
Hey, well, Steve led me astray, so what do you
I
do? Did.
No, it's a wee thing. It's not a you thing. It's not a me thing. It's a wee thing. So
yes.
Okay, so Planet of the Apes is what we're trying to talk about. So
no, but send me that link. I have to see that.
Yeah, if I can find it, I'll try and embed it in a blog post or maybe even in the show notes for this episode because it is really an interesting and clever. The way that they edited it, it was very clever and it works. I mean, he even puts in a commercial break. There's no commercials, but it fades to black and then fades back in. But,
so, Ben, what is it about Planet of the Apes that just captures your attention? Why did it have to be on this list?
Well, for me, Planet of the Apes... Charlton Heston is a lot of the reason why I like Planet of the Apes, the first one. I mean, he's so, what's the word I'm looking for? Raw and emotional.
That's what I was going to say. If you do not like Charlton Heston, your man card is instantly rejected. It's revoked.
It's like not liking Superman, right?
It's like, yeah, it's like Superman, Matt or whoever it is over there. and also it's like if you don't like Clint Eastwood or you know Stallone or something, you have to like these guys.
Yeah,
instant man code rejection.
But I do also like the ape characters as well. I think that they're the cool thing about the ape characters is that they are well rounded and not just villainous, although there is one who is just villainous. That's the only reason he's there. But there's the twists and the turns and the reveals and the way things are revealed and the ape makeup is very expressive, even though it's very rubbery. And yeah, that's one thing that doesn't stand the test of time in some ways, but in other ways it really does.
But Roddy McDowall he put this over for me. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, as much as Charlton Heston did it on, you know, a purely emotional human side, Roddy McDowall working that makeup and that mask, it was
what I love about it is he's in every single movie.
Yeah.
And the TV series. Different characters, but I mean obviously he made enough of an impression that they wanted to use him even when he was playing like his son or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I like the other movies too because there is a very strong thread, especially in the first two movies, of nihilism. The second movie, super nihilistic, super fatalistic. But at the same time, of course, they did that because Charlton Heston wanted no way for there to be any kind of sequel after that. So they said, okay, well, we'll just destroy the universe or whatever.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you guys this. We're supposed to pick five films pre-Star Wars. So where does Forbidden Planet and Planet of the Apes fit in your – is it 1, 2, 3, 4, 5? Where do you put those?
I didn't rank mine. I just picked five.
Yeah, I didn't rank them because I wanted the last one that I chose to have the impact that I wanted it to. I think if I was going to choose five, Planet of the Apes might be there, but it's not part of the five that I chose because I knew that someone else was going to choose it.
Okay.
Yeah. So.
All right. So.
But it would probably be.
So, but do you think Forbidden Planet would be in the top tier?
Oh, absolutely.
Forbidden Planet would be number one.
Okay.
Yeah.
I don't know if Forbidden Planet would be number one for me, but it's definitely in that top five. If I were to rank it, it'd be four or five or something like that.
It's one of the, I'm just looking down my list real quick. It's one of the, let's see, one, two, probably it would be one of the three movies where if I said to myself, you know what, I want to sit down and watch a science fiction movie that I've seen before pre Star Wars, it would be one of those three.
Would you really say that to yourself? I'm going to watch a sci-fi movie that's pre Star Wars. Is that your running monologue inside?
I probably would. Yes.
Okay.
To mine and everyone else's chagrin.
Well, I want to hear something else from your list because there's one that I have that is not on my list that. If it's on your list, it will be hard for me to be your friend, but it's one that many people like. So I need to hear the rest of your list so I can properly judge you.
Well, you've given your two So you've given half of your list.
Yeah.
40%. So let me throw one out there.
All right.
And this is one that when I was a kid, I didn't understand science fiction, obviously the way I do now, but I didn't really understand that this movie was science fiction. It just seemed like this stuff happened and then they made a film version of it. And when I watched it the first couple of times, the way it was framed was that this stuff actually did happen. And it put such a fright in me, put such a, like a, wait a minute, did that really happen? Type of a feel.
The Blair Witch Project.
No, similar. The Andromeda Strain.
Oh, interesting.
Okay. Yeah, Michael Crichton film.
I have actually not seen that.
Neither have I.
I won't ruin it for you, but it's a really interesting, these people are locked in a level of an underground base trying to figure out what this thing was that fell from the sky. And it keeps changing its effects. Like, for instance, when it first comes down, people are dying. And then the next time they encounter it, things are happening because of it that didn't happen before. So they figure it's mutating or something like that. And they have to keep looking at it at different times. And the characters are under different physical restraints. There's one who's, I think she's diabetic. So, she'll have like little mini blackouts. So, you know, she'll miss pivotal things. And then, you know, there's intrigue and there's drama and there's all these little things that could happen in a pre-Star Wars world. And you're drawn into it because the characters are just so, they're not over the top. They're not trying to sell their roles or anything like that. It's passably funny. There's some, you know, some funny little things that they put in there. And the way that they shoot it, it's almost like an X-Files episode where these things are happening, these people are involved, and, you know, some of them live, some of them die, and you're just wandering through and wondering to yourself, how is this going to work? And, of course, Crichton is a medical doctor, I believe. So,
yeah. Now, did he directed this as well, right?
I think it's one that he directed as well, yeah.
Because he wrote it and directed it and then probably wrote the book. But yeah, that's it. That's interesting. I've seen that on people's lists, but I've never actually seen it myself.
It's a good one. It's a slow burn. So, you know, if you go in there, make sure you have some caffeine at the beginning, and you're looking for sort of like, you know, almost like a Forbidden Planet type of a mystery going on there.
Okay.
All right. So here's one for my list that some people might not even include in sci-fi, but if you're a genre fan, you've probably. You know about it. You absolutely know about it. That's it. Godzilla. And Steve is singing the theme song right now. Yeah. Okay. So Godzilla, it is one of the best message sci-fi movies out there. And it's different than any other Godzilla movie. The first one is meant to be a horror movie, not because you're scared that this could really happen, that a giant lizard could walk through your city, but because of what the giant lizard represented to the people at the time. And that was, the Japanese people were still recovering in some ways from the nuclear blast, the only nuclear attack ever used on from one nation to another. And they were still recovering from that. And so here, then they also had a fishing boat that was caught in a test blast, and like just maybe 1 or 2 years before the movie came out. And that was actually another inspiration for this, was just, it's basically about the horrors of the nuclear age. But it is a horrible, horrible movie. There are children crying because their parents are dead. You see dead bodies, and in a lot of later Godzilla movies, you don't even see any dead bodies.
This is Raymond Burr before he was in the wheelchair.
Well, so. There's the two versions of this. There's the Japanese version, and then there's the American version, which is amazingly still pretty good, where they added in footage using Raymond Burr and cutting away to him with stand-in doubles of the Japanese actors from the original movie with their back to the camera. So it looks like he's standing in the scene with them. And they did a great job of making it more available or more accessible to American audiences then. But it is black and white, and I know that, that for a lot of people, that's a ding right there. Black and white, I don't care. But it's definitely one that if you've not seen the original Godzilla, this is a movie that it's part of your cultural heritage, man. Mm-hmm. You need to see where it started. And then the Godzilla franchise starts off this very serious, somber, scary movie, which is basically about a natural disaster, and then goes off into cheese camp. Godzilla becomes a superhero who rescues children from falling buildings and stuff,
mm-hmm.
and has his own son. Not Godzuki.
That's his other son, right?
Godzuki, I don't, that's a cartoon. What's his name? Minizilla or something like that? And then, you know, they try to get back into serious action movies with, you know, lately. And now they've got another Godzilla movie finally after, I think, 10 years now.
Yeah, but any sci-fi monster movie worth its salt takes its everything from from Godzilla. You know, Alien. It's...
As a kid, you're watching Godzilla and you're just thinking, this is cool. Look at the buildings falling down.
Yeah.
You know, though, I've never been able to get into a monster movie that, you know, where this big monster invades the city, with exception of, I actually very much enjoyed Cloverfield, because I think that what I liked about it was that you couldn't see, it was as if you were really in what would happen if you were really in that situation. That's how you felt in Cloverfield. But I've never really been able to get into the Godzillas. Obviously the newest Godzilla is just too funny. It's hard for me to really connect with this one.
Well, that's why you should try it. I mean, this is the kind of thing that...
No, I've tried it. I just don't like it.
Oh, you have?
Yes.
The original?
Yes.
Oh, I just find it interesting now, because the first time I watched it was in high school. I watched it with a group of friends. We were at an overnighter at our church, and we just... basically did Mystery Science Theater 3000 with it the whole way through, and just laughed and laughed and laughed. It was, you know, 3 a.m. and we were punch drunk with, you know, sugar or whatever. But
I understand,
but
though.
The now as an adult watching it, I'm watching it almost as a way to, as I'm watching it, I'm thinking, this is how it felt. This is an emotional response to what had happened. And
no, I get that. That's the thing that's interesting, and I might even add it into my with that in mind, I might even add it to my I teach a film class and teaching history of film. And I think that what you just said there about the history of the bomb and everything puts that Godzilla in a whole different light.
Yeah, and that's why I only recommend, for the purposes of this podcast, I only recommend that first Godzilla, because after that it goes off into just weirdness and bizarre, strange, campy, cheesy.
And if you like that stuff, I mean, go right ahead and finish watching the entire series.
Yeah. Well, and that's...
But
the series appeals to, like, different levels of me.
Right.
Oh, I like this because it's an emotional resonance. Oh, I like this one because it's really stupid.
Yeah.
and I can laugh at it. I'm having fun now watching some of these with my son. I wouldn't have watched it with my, you know, alone. But watching with my son, we're both just laughing and having fun with, not the original, but with some of the later ones.
So. Yeah.
All right. You got another one for us, Dr. Jace?
I do.
Okay.
My next movie scared the pants off of me. I watched it as a kid, and I didn't even know what I was watching. And then I just remembered at the end of it, I thought, there has to be a sequel. What happened? And it is Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
Oh, yes. Nice. Now, you're talking about the original?
1956.
Yes.
Yeah.
I started to try to find other body snatchers, and then I fell upon the Donald Sutherland version, which also scared the pants off of me.
That one's much creepier, I have to say.
But the issue I have with the Invasion of the Body Snatchers, the first one, is that, you know, I think the last scene is he hears of a truck and all these melons fall off of it, and, you know, it pans into his eyes. As if, oh my gosh, he's so scared. And I'm sitting there going, what happens after that?
Yeah.
And it's always stuck with me because I went on a search to try to find an answer to the ending of that story. And
there isn't one.
There isn't one. Yeah. And then the one the one, it just basically led to more questions with the Donald Sutherland. All I'll say is,
yeah, that movie.
That one even scared me even more.
Of course, you have Leonard Nimoy in that one.
Yeah.
Which
yeah,
was just amazing. But, okay, so the original, what's interesting to me about the original is the same kind of thing we're talking about with Godzilla, where what it's really about. And it's about the, it's about McCarthyism. It's about red communism and the infiltration of communists into our society. And it's so you can enjoy it as a, just a scary, creepy invasion movie.
Mm-hmm.
But then when you know what they were actually trying to say behind it, it's also pretty interesting.
Yeah. I mean, it's what they, basically what both of those films do is they play on the most latent fears of that culture of that time. And, you know, that's probably why it works on the different levels. But if you have any kind of fear of conspiracies,
yes,
don't watch Invasion of Body Snatchers. Don't watch it.
Nope.
Do yourself a favor. But I have to say it would be one of my top five because I remember it. I remember how I felt when I watched his eyes at the very end thinking, what happened to him?
I am so glad you had that on your list because I cut that from mine.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's one where I recognize it as being great. It just didn't make the impact on me that it did on other people, and I didn't have it on my list.
Okay, so, Steve, you got another one for us then?
I do. Let's see. I have to go back to my other thing here. And we have something that was very pivotal to me as I'm growing up and learning about different sci-fi tropes and things like that, and also the history of sci-fi, that who was the, you know, the first person who wrote a sci-fi story and things like that. This goes way back to the 1800s. Time Machine.
That was my next one.
Ah, cool.
That was my next one. Yeah.
But just, you know, first of all, the cinematography was great. In a cheesy sort of way, like, you know, he's watching the storefront window and he's seeing the fashions change and things like that. Because, you know, they would be up for a considerable amount of time before they're taken down. So he can actually see, you know, things like that. And the time machine itself, is just an iconic piece of, classic, machinery.
Classic. You know what? I included that in one of my books, Time Flies.
Oh, there it is. Ding, ding, ding.
I have a 2-page spread in that book that has like classic science fiction, time travel machines. And one of them was the Planet of the Apes ship. And one of them was the time machine from Time Machine. And one of them was the Enterprise and the DeLorean. Anyway, okay, carry on. But you can order Time Flies on Amazon. And,
all 8 issues.
Oh, my gosh.
Go ahead. Time Machine. Back to
time. Well, machine. I was going to say, you know, this is another one that I remember from my childhood and watching it left an impact on me because there's two things I always remember about the Time Machine and how I felt about it and what I thought about it. One was the blue creatures really freaked me out. I mean, they just were creepy looking. Now looking back on it, you know, it's they're a little bit humorous, but when I was younger, they were spooky, man. I mean, they're blue. And, but then the second thing, they had an issue, actually, I remember thinking about it, was I remember thinking he's in this building watching society changes, and then at no point does anybody ever change his particular area.
Yeah. Really.
So I'm sitting in, but what if, like, you know, somebody put a bookshelf where his – time machine was.
Exactly.
Or if they decided to tear down the building.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, here comes the wrecking ball. And,
yeah. And at some point they did decide to tear down the building and he was unaffected. I just was sitting there going, wait a minute. Now, if they're in the middle of trees or something, wouldn't there be something there in all of the thousands of years?
Yeah,
wouldn't
like there something a tree growing up underneath his time machine.
Yeah, and so I remember those two thoughts of mine. Those blue people are scary. And it scared me. Or I was trying to figure out how was he protected.
Yeah,
right. But I mean, at some point he must have had some sort of a field around him that could phase through things because, you know, at one point he's inside a rock formation. You know. because the rocks of whatever, you know, built up over time or whatever, over the thousands of years that he's going into the future. So he's inside rock. And at that point, you're sort of like, what happens now? I mean, can he stop and turn around? Does he have to just keep going until he's outside of it? I mean, just like you felt there, you know, it was like, it was all new. You know, it reminded me a lot too of, what's the name of the book? There's a writer named Charles Williams who wrote back in the 1930s. And, he wrote a time travel story where it's just a very early type of time travel story where they find this gem. It's actually a cube, and they don't know, they're testing it, you know? So at one point they send someone back in time and the person never comes back, and they realize, we just created an endless loop for this person. They won't go back in time, and there's nothing for them. There's just an endless loop, and they realize that they've lost this person in time.
And that relates to the time machine?
My point was, it had the same feel to it, where things happen in the time machine, where as a kid, you're experiencing, even though it's more of a kid's movie, you're experiencing it for the first time, so you don't know what's going to happen. You don't know all the rules of the time machine. And in this other book, I'll blanking on the name, Many Dimensions is what it's called. They're learning the rules as they go along. So you're reading the book and they're testing it in different ways that is, you know, catastrophic in some ways to some of the people that they're testing it on, but they don't know because they haven't tested it before. So it was that same sort of sense when I read Many Dimensions after I saw the time machine. It just it recalled that interesting feeling of, this is a test. We don't know what's going to happen. You know, this is all new.
All right. So you got one more. Is that correct, Dr. Jace?
Yeah, I only have one more.
Okay. I think I have two more, but they kind of go together. Well, not really. Not really. Okay, this one, I hesitated because on one level it's just a classic and it just, you can't ignore it. But on another level, it's not as great as its status.
I wonder if it's the one I'm thinking.
Is it War of the Worlds that you were thinking?
No, I wasn't. Okay. I wasn't actually.
So War of the Worlds.
I thought about that one actually.
War of the Worlds, I like it. I mean, the effects were groundbreaking at the time and still do kind of, for the most part, hold up. There's a really tense scene that I remember as a kid where you actually see the alien and you're just like, what in the world is going to happen here? But the ending is what does it for me, that just made me almost say, and it's interesting because it's another H.G. Wells story.
Yeah.
You know, H.G. Wells, he's totally, an atheist, right? I mean,
he's very pessimistic.
Very pessimistic, but he has this happy ending to War of the Worlds that implies design. And in fact, in Steven Spielberg's version of this movie, they say God did this. You know, God created this world to have this thing that's going to cause us to be able to not get completely annihilated. And
I think that, you know, that actually reminds me of a current sci-fi or recent one called Signs. Some people didn't like the ending of Signs, but I'm like, first of all, I love Signs. And I said, this is just like, you know, War of the Worlds. It's just like it. I don't want to, for those who haven't seen it, you should, because it's been a while, but that's what it reminds me of.
The one difference is for Signs, that was the entire point of the movie. The entire point of that story is this happened and this sequence of events happens.
Yeah.
All right.
For War of the Worlds, it's just like, okay, well, the aliens took over. The aliens completely obliterate us. We cannot fight them. We cannot win. Oh, but.
I was going to say, I think that to me, that looks like a publisher said, hey, you need to fix this ending because this pressing thing is not working. It won't sell anything.
But what I love about it is in the movie, it happens while they're all basically hunkered down and huddled down in a church. And it really is. I can't remember if in the movie they call out that, you know, God and his infinite wisdom or whatever. But it feels like that. And there's a lot of sci-fi after that movie where they did that, where it's, oh, you know, these aliens can't handle UV rays, and you know, so our ozone layer depletion is going to kill them, or things like that, where it's just, it's nothing that humans did, nothing the characters did. The characters in the movie just survive.
Right.
That's what they do. So I go back and forth about, does this make it into my top five? But I think it ultimately does.
There's some iconic stuff that has carried over. I mean, 50 years later, you still have spaceships, you know, based on those designs. Sure, they, you know, the way that the Millennium Falcon and those ships were built, you know, that design quality comes out as well. But you still have, a lot of ship design and architectural design going back to that. And,
organic kind of design.
Where Earth feels versus like, the Martian or stuff like that. I mean, just those good quality old time movies that had whoever was putting that labor of love into the ships and into the design.
Well, with the War of the Worlds, instead of this flying saucer, like Forbidden Planet, that's one ding that Forbidden Planet gets is, although I do like it, Forbidden Planet is about humans in a flying saucer invading another planet, basically. or not invading, but like exploring and you know, taking samples and stuff. But they're in a flying saucer, which also, you get the Enterprise from that in some ways. Mm-hmm. But with these ships in War of the Worlds, they're organic. They look like they were grown on a tree, or something like that. And you get these, like you said, there's reminiscence of that design in like Babylon 5.
What I think is interesting about almost all of the ones that we've said is that there's been modern, recent remakes, except with the exception of Forbidden Planet, unless you count the Star Trek franchise. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think the rest of them have gotten reboots of some sort.
Yeah, well, I think the Forbidden Planet probably wouldn't get the reboot just because it is so similar to Star Trek. How would you make it so much different than Star Trek, but still keep it in the realm of...
Hollywood is a business of copycats, so if they thought they could make money off of it, absolutely they would.
Bet after the Star Trek reboot, whoever owns the rights to Forbidden Planet was saying, okay, how can we do a Forbidden Planet reboot?
No, I don't think that hit them. I don't think that hit them until they listened to this podcast, and then there's somebody at Sony or Fox or something going, you know what? These guys are brilliant. We need to do a Forbidden Planet movie.
We need these three working on it.
Yeah.
Stat!
No, that'd be too smart for Hollywood to have us do that. How's that for hubris right there?
Wow.
The hubris of man.
The hubris of man.
All right. What do you got for us, Steve? One more. Wait, are you at the end of your list?
Let's see. Well, are we putting...
Him and I had several of the same.
Are we putting Forbidden Planet off? Like everyone chose it, so then we get five more?
No.
Okay. So let's see.
You should have one or two left.
I got Forbidden Planet. I got Andromeda Strain. I got Time Machine.
That's three.
So let's see. For my fourth, I'm looking around on my list here. I think I'm going to go with... Boy, this is tough.
The anticipation is boring me.
I'm just gonna go with my.
Why don't you go?
The Day the Earth Stood Still.
Okay. I knew someone was gonna take that.
And that's the one that you didn't want.
No.
That's not the one you hate. Your friend with this movie.
You can.
Okay, good.
You're lucky, but yes.
I am lucky.
Can still be your friend.
I am lucky to have a friend like you.
Aww.
Who is willing to put my friendship on the line because of a movie. Wait.
Yes.
There's something in here.
Skype hug.
What?
Skype hug.
Yeah.
Day the Earth Stood Still would have been the one I would have just chose right there. So,
okay,
excellent.
We're good. Day the Earth Stood Still. And Jace, you like it too, huh?
I do.
Again, this is just iconic. But this is the first movie that as a child I got the message. And part of it is because the main character sits down with the other main character and says, this is what this movie is about. this movie is about this, this, and this, and this is what you're supposed to learn from this movie because you as the characters are learning it right now.
Right.
But it terrified me, this idea of just everything that's mechanical stopping
mm-hmm.
and standing still. And, But I love that,
you know, that would have pretty much frozen my fifth grade teacher.
He was a robot? Cyborg?
Pretty much.
Android?
But I also love that he, you know, planes were still flying. You know? Like, it's okay. I can control it so that planes aren't affected. No one is going to die from this. But now I haven't seen the remake, but Dr. Jace, as soon as you said, it's interesting how all these are remakes, I thought, oh yeah, it is. And then I look at my list. Oh, the next one on my list is a remake. But this is, you know, you have Gort is just that classic alien robot design that's just amazing. And I love that the flying saucer comes down and he reaches out with his hand, just the first thing, and we attack him. You know, we are the aggressors, and these aliens are actually here. They want to help us out, man. Yeah. And there's just so many different things like that in that movie. It goes back to that Twilight Zone feel of it's saying something, and it's connecting with you on a couple different levels.
Very Twilight Zone-y.
And it helps that the characters are likable, except for the kid. Child actors before Star Wars, big problem for me. Child actors actually after Star Wars, a big problem too. But
yeah.
Okay. So, Steve, this was your last one as well?
No, that was my fourth.
And so now this is Steve's last one.
I have one more.
And I have one more, and you have one more, right, Dr. Jace?
Yes.
Okay. And also, Dr. Jace has one that if we choose it...
We can't be his friend.
We can't be his friend.
Yeah. I reserve my fifth one for one that I can't stand, and anybody who enjoys it is is cast out.
Anathema.
Okay.
Okay, well, this is one I chose, and I chose this because of the last monologue of the film.
So this is not my movie.
This is not your movie.
No.
It might be mine.
It might be. But the thing is, when you watch
Green.
No.
Okay.
When you watch the movie, you're not getting this sense of it's going here. You know, you get this fatalistic sense of it. A little hope, but a little fatalistic. And then when you really realize what is happening to the lead character, the main character of this film, you have this sense of, oh no, how can it end that way? And the ending monologue is just, it's wonderful. And it brings science fiction and a spiritual aspect, almost a Christian aspect to it.
And
it's, what is it?
The Incredible Shrinking Man.
Oh,
But listen, this is is the last bit.
I haven't seen it.
It's not too long.
I haven't seen it either. Don't ruin it for me.
Well, he's shrinking.
Spoiler alert.
This is a huge spoiler alert because I want to read the ending monologue here.
Well, I'm putting down my earbuds because I don't want to hear. I want to watch it myself.
Okay, well, if you want to, you can do that too. But he's shrinking and he's monologuing. And he says, I was continuing to shrink to become... What? The infinitesimal? What was I? Still a human being? Or was I the man of the future? If there were other bursts of radiation, other clouds drifting across seas and continents, would other beings follow me into this vast new world? So close, the infinitesimal and the infinite. But suddenly, I knew they were really two ends of the same concept, the unbelievably small and the unbelievably vast. Eventually meet like the closing of a gigantic circle. I looked up as if somehow I would grasp the heavens, the universe, worlds beyond number, God's silver tapestry spread across the night. And in that moment, I knew the answer to the riddle of the infinite. I had thought in terms of man's own limited dimension. I had presumed upon nature. That existence begins and ends in man's conception, not nature's. And I felt my body dwindling, melting, becoming nothing. My fears melted away, and in their place came acceptance. All this vast majesty of creation, it had to mean something. And then I meant something, too. Yes, smaller than the smallest, I meant something, too. To God, there is no zero. I still exist.
Okay. The dramatic reading by Steve MacDonald.
Oh, okay, all I know is that was one long monologue. Because I put my earbuds in my fist and close them so I don't hear anything, and then I'll release my fist just a little bit, and I'm like, he's still talking. My goodness, that was long.
But you know what? You missed it. It was good. So it's interesting.
Okay, I now have to watch it.
I want to see this movie now.
I do. I've got to see it.
And even if you don't, if it's just not your movie, if it's just like Yawn Fest, Dr. Jace, just fast forward to like the last 2-3 minutes of the film, okay? And logically take the steps to get to that point. Okay.
Or just listen to what you just read.
I'll just watch the film.
You can do that.
That's interesting that that's on your, like, that's the top of your list. But after reading that monologue or hearing that monologue, that's, yeah, I see what you're saying. We can't talk about it too much now that Dr. Jace is back, but
yeah. But if you're looking at stuff in a spiritual and science fiction realm, I think this is one of the pivotal crossroads that you have to understand.
Nice. Okay, so Dr. Jace, we need to do yours next, your last one next, because we want to hold off and see if my next one is the one that you can't.
Well, I'm kind of like, I'm afraid that you're going to pick it.
Well,
my whole thing is that if I tell you and then it was yours, I don't really know if you're going to change it.
No. I'm not going to. You're going to tell us your last one. The don't you have one more?
I do have one more, but it's the deal breaker.
But if I tell you and it's the one you were going to pick. I don't know that you're going to change your mind just because you want to keep our friendship.
Wait. I don't understand. You put this on your list, but this is the game changer. This is the one that.
Yes.
So you pick it, but if I pick it, you hate me.
I not necessarily hate. I disown you.
Oh, okay. I don't understand. You're disowning yourself by picking it yourself.
No. I reserved my last one for a hated pick, not one that I loved.
Oh, in the email I said we could all pick one that we hated.
Oh.
That we don't choose.
Oh, okay.
So your list is done, though. I should go ahead and say mine. Okay, I was confused there.
Steve and I, and you and I had several of the same.
Right, okay, so my last one, and I can't believe no one had this on their list, but now that I'm about to say this, you're going to disown me. I know this is the one you're going to disown, and it's 2001.
Yes, you are not my friend. You are not my friend.
Wow.
I think that 2001, if you are a science fiction fan, is a movie you have to see at least once.
And that is it. Then you need therapy afterwards.
No. You go into the movie, you know that you're watching. Here's what you need to know before you watch this movie. First of all,
you're watching a space ballet.
It's an anthology. It's four different movies. And you can actually stop it in between them, but you shouldn't. It's actually four different stories.
And they're still boring.
Oh, it is a long, drawn-out, quiet, very hardly any
quiet
dialogue.
So quiet, people in a cemetery would still be bored.
Well, I don't quite understand that, but I'll go with you on the quiet part. it is Stanley Kubrick, and he's doing what he does, which is naturalistic. Which means it's so the dialogue is basically so real that you don't like it because it's
Stanley Kubrick, aka the most overrated director of all time.
Whoa!
I wouldn't say the most overrated.
Who would you pick as more overrated than Stanley Kubrick?
I'd have to think about it. He's definitely overrated.
George Lucas.
Some of his. Okay, so here's why this is the movie you. As a science fiction fan, need to see and see it once, get through it. I guarantee that there are things that you'll be watching this and you're saying, oh my goodness, wake me up. Okay. But the problem with that,
that time will probably come every 10 minutes when you see a gigantic black domino.
You've got the opening sequence that is, at the dawn of man. And then you've got the next sequence, which is when we are in space in 2001 and discover a black domino on the moon.
And this is like an evolutionary dawn of man, not like a God's creation dawn of man.
It's apes.
Yeah, so it's not just stupid, but it's also, you know, stupid.
And then you have the whole thing with Hal, the computer, and the ship.
Hello, Dave.
The ship that goes to Jupiter and has Hal on board as their operating system, basically, and he murders them. I mean, he's a murderer. He goes crazy. And it's about isolation. It's terrifying. The last time I watched it, last week, actually, I was reminded again just how this isolation and this sense of hopelessness is just, it's oppressive. But you need to see it just for...
And that's why it's so good.
You need to see it for the special effects. You need to see it because of what it's trying to say. And what it's trying to say is wrong in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
But you need to know it. You need to know what they're doing. You need to know what they've done.
So let me get this right.
Yeah.
There's a dumb beginning.
I didn't say it's a dumb beginning. I like the beginning.
It's an overrated director, the overrated director, and the message of the movie is bad.
Now, when you say, let
and
me
this
get
this. Is the top five.
No. The message of the movie is sometimes wrong, but the message of the movie, ultimately, it gets there the wrong way. But the message of the movie is that there's more to life than mankind. There's more to life than what we have physically, I should say. There's more to mankind than just the physical. And there's a rebirth that happens after death.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the way he gets there is wrong.
Right.
But to me, it's like War of the Worlds with H.G. Wells. He couldn't avoid that ending because he had to have a happy ending. You know, and so here's this guy who's writing this book, which became this movie. Now, the movie was done by, you know, 1950s era Americans. And so they're going to draw out this, oh, God helped us or whatever. But with 2001, again, he makes this movie that's about the isolation of man and how we are basically infinitesimal, kind of like with the monologue there. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, there's more to it.
See, for me, if you know anything about Stanley Kubrick and his work, it's hard for me to see, because you see his, you know, fatalistic, humanistic elements in everything that he does. And I just don't enjoy them. And not only that, I just think it's not very good. I don't think it's very... Now, I'm not going to say, obviously, in 2001, there's some amazing visuals.
Right.
But you know what? I could go through Google pictures and see really cool visuals. I want to go...
This is before then.
Yeah, this is the first time. This is when the technology was created. It was created for this movie. 2001 is similar to Star Wars in that the technology was created to tell this story rather than just let's use the technology to make a story. And so this is the beginning. And you've got the model work. You've got the hard sci-fi ideas where they're actually – and it's not just Kubrick. It's Stanley I just blanked on his name. No, not Stanley. Stanley Kubrick and Arthur C. Clarke, both very, very humanistic, although Arthur C. Clarke may have made some concessions later on in life. But, it's a cold movie.
I'm not saying that it's not historically relevant.
Watch it with the sound off.
I'm sorry, what?
Watch it with the sound off.
But even with the sound on, I think this is the first time you're hardwiring old, established... classical music to science fiction. And this is why we don't have a lot of science fiction movies, serious science fiction movies that have, you know, heavy metal or rock and roll to them. Most of the time we have, Alexander Courage or, you know, someone, John Williams, doing these wonderful, beautiful pieces of work for these films because Stanley Kubrick set this up. You know, you have also Spock Zarathustra, and you have all these, the Blue Danube and everything, you know, these wonderful pieces that a lot of people only know because it was in these movies.
Yeah. Right. Again, it's historically significant, but it's in your top five favorites. I mean, there's a lot of films like, I like A Thin Red Line, Malick's A Thin Red Line, because it's because of its storytelling and because of its aesthetic attractiveness, but I would not put it in a top five films. And you're saying this is your top, one of your top five sci-fi?
This is one of my top five pre-Star Wars sci-fi movies.
Yeah. Wow. Is that because it's so good or because there's so few good pre-Star Wars sci-fi films?
Yes and no and yes.
Well, the way that I picked my list was more or less how they impacted me. And that's why I didn't pick Metropolis, because I didn't see it until much later in life. I didn't pick... I'm looking at some other stuff. I didn't put Planet of the Apes up there, even though it was seminal to me growing up. You know, I watched the cartoon, I watched the TV show. Roddy McDowall was my favorite actor before Star Wars. So, but even with that, you know, I saw too much of, you know, an evolutionary mindset going into the movie that I didn't feel like I could put that on my top five.
And that's why, Steve, from now on, you're going to have to talk in between Ben and I, because I can't talk to him directly now. So I'll just tell you what I need you to tell him, and then he can talk through you as well.
Yes, sir.
All right. So,
but you know, I didn't pick Logan's Run because there's nudity in it, and I wouldn't want someone to run out and go watch this thing. You know, I mean, and there's lots of stuff like that. Fantastic Voyage was fantastic, except it was so slow and boring at parts.
So wait, Steve, is this your really sly way of trying to get in
all the movies
films.
You didn't choose? Yeah.
Yes. Not of This Earth, When Worlds Collide, This Island Earth, Rollerball.
Rocky Horror Picture Show.
The Man of Pebble Earth, Earth versus the Flying Saucers. Well, Colossus the Forbin Project.
Them.
I want to see that, by the way. I want to see Colossus the Forbin Project. I hear so much about it, but I've never actually seen it. Okay, so let's like, move on. We like, need to move on into our
Steve, war games before
Steve,
war games.
Can you tell Ben that we need to move on
into
we
our?
We need to move on, Ben.
We need to move on into our feedback section because we got a lot of feedback to go and talk about. Mailbag. So, first of all, oh my, I'm so sorry. Actually, no, I'm not.
Westworld, The Invisible Man, The Thing from Outer Space.
Steve. Although Westworld was one that I had to cut from my list. Sleeper with Woody Allen, I had to cut that from my list too.
Really?
Wow. Yeah. Yeah.
I didn't hear something. Steve, did somebody just say something?
Oh, this is going to get old.
Ben, I think we need to move it along.
Okay, so.
I'm surprised no one picked Solaris.
That was on my list of ones that I cut toward the end. Like, I wanted to put it on there, but I cut it.
That's on my list to see. I still haven't seen that one.
I really... It's 3 hours long. It's a foreign film. And if you thought 2001 was long and dry and cold, then you haven't seen anything yet.
Cool.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay, so...
Day of the Triffids.
So into our feedback section now. First of all, we posted this question on Twitter and Facebook. What are your favorite pre-Star Wars sci-fi fantasy movies? So a Twitter user named Ms. Wendy, who's a blogger and podcaster about Lost. Her handle is Bunnies LR Now. I don't understand the Twitter handle, although I do. I've been following her for a while on my Twitter as well. She said Logan's Run. That was her favorite pre-Star Wars sci-fi fantasy movie. Another Twitter guy, Kyle Schold, he said Planet of the Apes 1968. On Facebook, Hank Harwell, he said Metropolis, Silent Running, and Dark Star. Metropolis because of its huge influence on sci-fi films that followed. Silent Running because it is an important bridge between 2001 and Star Wars. Again, Silent Running is one that I... cut from my list, but I would put it on there, although it's very also kind of nihilistic. And Star Wars, visually speaking, he said. And then Dark Star because science fiction humor is so very rare. And I haven't seen Dark Star, but it was written by the guys who wrote Aliens, I think, or Alien, the first one.
Yeah.
Dave Goulet, my friend, he said the Sinbad films, Jason and the Argonauts, Godzilla, and War of the Worlds.
Yeah, Ray Harryhausen did lots of fantasy stuff. I didn't choose a lot of stuff that crossed over into fantasy on my list. And Sinbad, you know, even though fantastic movie, I think it would be a little bit too much into the fantasy realm to choose it for sci-fi. But still a good pick.
Well, Jason and the Argonauts, I had on my list, but I cut it off. Like, I had a list of 10, and cut it down. And that one, again, special effects and visual things happening there, that it's, that's the first time you're seeing some of that stuff, or the best anyway. Okay. Then Bud Rogers says Planet of the Apes first in particular, but the whole series too. And then he also said, I'm pretty partial to Creature from the Black Lagoon. Then Dave Goulet comes back and says, Planet of the Apes. Yes. Forgot that one. Add that to my top 10 pre-Star Wars list too. And then Angela Bussard. I hope I didn't butcher your name, Angela. I apologize.
Bussard.
She said The Little Prince, which I thought was very interesting.
Yeah.
My dad's work had a Christmas party for its employees and their families, and they treated us to this movie. I love how so much of the movie is shown through the eyes of a child and a man who, deep down inside, probably wishes he could see life like a child. And Little Prince is interesting. I only know the book. I saw the movie once in, like, junior high, I think, and it was just so very weird. But the book, I love, love, love the book. And it's kind of a science fiction fantasy. It's about a little prince, kid, who lives on an asteroid that he can walk around in one day or less. And he has one plant on the asteroid, and birds fly by, and he catches a ride to Earth and meets a pilot who fell, who crashed in the middle of the desert. Yeah. It's I recommend it as a book. The movie, I just remember being really, really weird. Weird in that original Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. Weird in that sense. And then we had two more here. Joe Baden, an artist that I know from Facebook, he said Invasion of the Body Snatchers, 2001, Metropolis, Carnival of Souls, and Forbidden Planet. Carnival of Souls I haven't seen.
It's more of a horror movie. I don't know if I'd put it into the sci-fi fantasy realm, but you know, as much as horror can be, I'd have to go back and think about it again, because I don't know. Yeah, you know, there's some horror movies that could just happen every day. You know, there could be a crazy guy running around with an axe in the woods. That's not sci-fi fantasy. But when it goes into the realm of
supernatural,
you know,
and
yeah, fantasy. I mean, Pan's Labyrinth is a horror, but it's fantasy. Yeah. So, you know, you can have the crossover. I don't think every horror movie crosses over there.
Finally, so. Buzz Dixon, he said 2001: A Space Odyssey, The Final Program, also known as The Last Days of Man on Earth, Planet of the Apes, Death Race 2000,
nice.
Forbidden Planet, Things to Come, and Metropolis. And, you know, Metropolis and Things to Come, those are both very much that early science fiction where it's, here's, we're looking at the future. Things to Come, I think, was written by H.G. Wells.
H.G. Wells,
as a movie originally, from what
I
understand.
That still has some iconic stuff that you could see in modern movies as well.
And then Metropolis is the first. And I think if I were to make a list of must-see movies, just like 2001, Metropolis is one to see because we reference it so much.
It's not really a good way to sell me on it.
Well, you know, it's an interesting story too, but Blade Runner, influenced by Metropolis. The Last Total Recall, influenced by Metropolis. Star Wars, influenced by Metropolis. Metropolis casts a very, very long shadow.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But it's also a silent movie. So I know that right there is putting off a lot of people. Okay, so Tom Holst sent us a bunch of emails, and I went a little bit back and forth with him on those. They were very, very long. And so I'm not going to read all of his email or all of his emails, but I am going to read the one that he sent us about Batman, the Dark Knight Rises, rather, if I can find it here. So Tom Holst sent us some emails, and he really disagreed with us about Avengers. He really disagreed with us about, or me anyway, about Spider-Man. But here's what he said about Dark Knight Rises, and so this is the one that I wanted to read here. He says, I liked it very much. I totally agree with your assessment of the Dark Knight trilogy being like the original Star Wars trilogy. The first blew our minds because we'd never seen anything like it. The second one actually managed to top it, and the third one is very good, but can't live up to the expectations of the other two because no film could. He said he thinks Bruce Wayne is still alive at the end. I think it's kind of a cheat that he was apparently able to get away at the last second, since the editing clearly shows him in the cockpit, as you said. But it's even a bigger cheat in my mind if Alfred was just daydreaming again in those final moments. And then he also said something interesting that I haven't heard anyone say this yet. He said, finally, let me point out what a lot of people seem to have missed, that by making The Dark Knight Rises well, Nolan has done something no one else has ever been able to do before. Make a satisfying third superhero movie. Superman 3, Batman Forever, X-Men 3, all staggeringly disappointing. But now, finally, there's a good third movie out there. For that alone, Nolan deserves a massive amount of praise. So that was from our listener, Tom Holst. And I found that interesting, too. So,
well, I have to say that it's not as bad as other third in the series. But I don't know if I'd put it into the realm of great.
Oh, I think that it's as far as superhero movies, I think it's the most stable of the three all the way through. I mean, I can't think of another one. You know, I would still argue Lord of the Rings is a better trilogy, but that's not a superhero movie.
Right. Yeah, and he disagreed with me about me putting Lord of the Rings trilogy in the same category where the first one blows you away, the second one tops it, and the third one manages to be in there. He disagreed with that assessment. But
yeah.
Okay, so tonight's a very special day for you, Dr. Jace, because Michigan plays tonight, right?
Oh, yeah.
Tonight's a very special day for geeks around the world who aren't Dr. Jace, because Doctor Who is premiering the new episode tonight. Of course, it'll have premiered by the time you've heard this episode, but we're going to be recording a special Doctor Who episode with Steve's wife and with another guest. So
she's a huge fan from the 70s right on up.
And so we'll be talking Doctor Who next episode.
Yeah.
And I'm excited about this. Have you seen the Pond Life prequel things?
Steve? Haven't seen it, no.
Oh, they're fun. They're fun.
I know, I got to check them out.
So,
sometime before tonight.
All right. Well, I was going to talk about our Facebook contest, but we'll hold off on that a little bit. And I think we'll just say goodbye. What do you think?
Can I just have one last thing to sort of pull the science fiction-y thing full circle?
Okay.
The new movie came out like last year. Hugo was sort of an homage to Georges Méliès. I'm probably butchering his name, but he's French. And one of his seminal first films, you've probably seen it in tons of different things. The Smashing Pumpkins made a video homage to this. It's the moon with the
oh yeah yeah
round the bullet looking space capsule in the eye. That image is from his Trip to the Moon, which is a 14-minute black and white soundless short back in 1902. It's so influential that people, I mean, they just made a movie about him trying to bring, you know, his stuff back to light. And his stuff is so influential that people are still using his concepts even to this day. I just saw something the other day. It was a kid's cartoon. Where I think it made Tom and Jerry or someone, but as the first thing had a moon with a rocket ship in the eye. So, I mean, it's 100 years later and he's still doing it. No one had it on their list. It's a 14-minute black and white soundless.
But isn't Hugo about, in some ways, about preserving these old movies?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
So it's, all of these movies, though, are developing the language of sci-fi and the language of cinema. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think, part of why, you know, why 2001 gets up there for me. And
right.
And this, the movie you're talking about, that's, again, they were just learning the language of what cinema looks like, what yeah. film looks like.
And special effects and...
And what you can actually accomplish, yeah.
Edit, yep.
All right, well, let's say goodbye then, guys.
Goodbye, guys.
Goodbye.
Godspeed.
You've been listening to the Strangers and Aliens podcast, hosted by Ben Avery, Dr. Jace O'Neill, and Steve McDonald. Our music was composed and mixed by Tim Leffel. We invite you to join the conversation by visiting our website, www.strangersandaliens.com, where you'll find show notes, articles, reviews, and more. You can also follow us on Twitter, where we are @StrangeAndAlien, or like us on our Facebook page. If you'd like to email us directly, our email is podcast@strangersandaliens.com. And once again, thanks for listening.
You are not my friend.